If people can quieten down. Thank you. Okay, welcome to this session. My name's Alison, and I'll be chairing. So this is a session on WikiLeaks and the War on Terror. It's a panel discussion with Josh and Chip, and I'll introduce them in just a second. But just so that people know, I'm sure everyone's heard the announcement, but dinner will be served in the bar downstairs after this meeting, and so we encourage you to stick around for that. And there's other events this evening that I'll announce at the end as well. The format for this panel will be both Josh and Chip will speak for about 10 to 20 minutes each, and then there'll be time for discussion and comments and questions from the floor, and then they'll come back as well at the end. So there will be time for questions. Write them down or keep them in your mind as you're listening, and we'll try to get through as many as possible. But, okay, just to start, I will introduce the speakers as they speak. Our first speaker is our guest, Chip Henris, who has very kindly come along to speak to us today. He has been an activist for about 10 years or so here in Australia. He's currently involved in activism around Indigenous rights. And Chip has also been a member of a group called Steadfast, which is an anti-war... Standfast, an anti-war soldiers organisation. And he's going to speak to us a little bit about the experiences that he's had in being involved in that group as well. So please welcome Chip.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming along and hearing us, and then hopefully educating me back, which always happens. And I love these kinds of discussions because of it. First thing I guess I'd like to speak about is I tell a little bit of my story and how I came to become an activist, so to speak, or a Marxist or a socialist, or, all these labels that we have, and what it meant to me. As you can probably hear from my outrageous accent, that I grew up in America, and I came here in 1987. And I came from a working class family in the United States. Mom and Dad migrated from Austria, from Vienna. Both of them grew up during the war in Europe. And, of course, because they were Austrians, they weren't like the von Trapps, unfortunately. My family welcomed the Nazis with open arms and thought it was a really great thing until everything fell around them. My dad's sister was paralyzed. She couldn't walk. And she was taken away and euthanized by the Nazis. My dad's brother was on the Russian front. He was in the 3rd SS Panzer Division, Totenkopf. My mom's father was in the 88th German Infantry Division fighting on the Russian front. And he was captured at the end of the war, luckily, by the Americans. My dad's brother was able to hide the fact that he was a SS soldier, and he survived Russian prison camp and came home in 1950. We had another uncle who was captured at Stalingrad in the 44th Austrian Division, and he came home in 1955. So the German army in World War II had a huge impact on me and who I was, especially growing up in the United States. Like Australia, World War II is talked about constantly. And growing up as a young man, I heard all about these stories of other kids talking about granddad and how he was in the war and did all these wonderful things. And I could never say my granddad was also awesome because he was a Nazi. Right. But it had a huge impact. And as I started to grow up on hearing ethics, especially from our large Jewish community in the United States about the horrors of the Holocaust and all these terrible things, I just started thinking, oh, my God, we're just horrible people. Turn on the TV, get a bit of light entertainment. I turn on, it's Hogan's Heroes or Allo Allo, and the Germans are all stereotypes and speaking like this. And we're just horrible people that deserve everything bad that should happen to us. And then I started to hear the stories from my family as well. And this is my uncle. He loves me. He's awesome to me. He doesn't really have anything against these people or that people. And I heard all these bad things about the war. My parents, my grandmother was raped by the Red Army. My mother remembers it. She was down in the cellar when the Russians took her village. My dad remembers being bombed out and put on the streets and people crying and all this horrible, horrible stuff. Had a big impact on me. So I decide when I'm 18 years old, a few things happen in my life. Fuck it, I'm joining the Marines. And the Marine Corps, for those who don't know, is not the Navy. The Navy drives the ships. Marines are shock troops that ride on the ships and assault the land. And part of my personality wanted to be really manly. And there's part of my personality that was like, I've got to be tough, you know. I'm a bit insecure maybe, and I want to be tough. And if I can get through the Marines and focus, I'll do it. And I did. And I got through boot camp and I came out as a private first class and I felt really good about myself. And they stationed me in California. And in California, I was in what we called the Fleet Marines. They were horrible. It was like jail. So you get in there and you live in a room this size with just bunk beds. You're 19 years old. You want to be out meeting girls or whatever and having a great time. And I'm stuck in there like it's military, you know. Surprise, surprise. It's not very pleasant. And the biggest bastards, the strongest guys, rule the roost, just like you'd see in jail. And I didn't like it. Got kind of like involved in religion because, you know, ultra-conservative politics and religion over there go hand in hand. And in the Marines, it's really embodied. And then we went overseas on a ship, kind of visiting and having war games and stuff with all these countries. And we came to the Philippines, and I saw how we kind of exploited the people. I saw little girls that were only 12 years old. We crossed this bridge from the base going into Olongapo City, crossing the bridge, and the little girls would be on the boats lifting their shirts up for money, and the Marines and sailors would throw money and things like that. And everything started confusing me. Needless to say, the ship came down to Australia where we worked with the Australian Army, and my ship ended up going for R&R and stunning Hobart, and I promptly said hasta la vista and stayed in Australia and went and met some friends that I'd known from years before, Australians, and I was illegal migrant here for 9 months, got married, went back to the U.S., got discharged, and then felt really guilty about my country. I left the Marines. I didn't do my duty, all these horrible things. And I was at university up in Toowoomba, and they said, why don't you come become an officer in the Australian Army? I said, that sounds good. Maybe they'll let me in. Told them my story. They let me in. The Australians made me an officer. And I became an officer in the Army Reserve as an infantry guy, so leading a platoon. And, you know, there's a lot of fun things about the military, which we can go into a bit later, especially collective living and sorts of things. There's some really good things about it. And being a boss in the Army was even better. So they, but while I was doing that, I was working as a civilian journalist. This is now 1994. And the Australian Army said, why don't you come into the regular Army and be a media officer? I said, sounds good. Because being an infantry officer is kind of hard. And I wasn't getting younger. I was already about 27 or so. And thinking, yeah, I'll be a media officer. And you get, you know, to drive around in air-conditioned four-wheel drives and you fly around in helicopters. You have a great time. And you get to be everywhere. So, like, I'm not in the infantry. I still have a gun. I still get to go everywhere. And when we went to East Timor in September of 1999, I was on the very first plane with the – there's Mick Slater. He's a general now looking after the floods. He was the battalion commander. And I was sitting next to him and the legal officer and the infantry battalion flying straight into Dili on September 20th, 1999. Was it September 20th? I think so. Anyway, we land in East Timor and I get to be part of it. I'm on TV and it's amazing. I'm feeling like I'm a real part of history and I haven't really had to do anything except go there and kind of manage the media. And, you know, it was a bit scary, I've got to admit. And there was human shit everywhere and Billy and things like that. But then seeing the country, as things died down and the media absolutely lost interest in us, there was nothing much for me to do. So I started teaching the local kids English and going to the school and meeting people. And I guess I became a bit close to the community. I was in Suai, which is on the border with West Timor. And I just started changing. I'd already been kind of green in my politics, but this was starting to radicalize me because I started to think, this is the way most of the world lives. They don't live in the burbs in Australia where we just have so much food that we have an obesity problem, which I contribute to. But this is how most people live. Why is it this way? We had heard, if any of you were in the economics talk today, that we actually have enough resources to feed everybody, educate everybody, house everyone all over the world. We could do it, yet we don't. And the more I started to look into problems, I joined the Timor Sea Justice Campaign. And the more I started looking into these sorts of problems, the more I started to see there were more and more reasons. And the reasons always came back to the same bastards time and time again. The environment problem, same bastards are at fault. The war problem, same bastards are at fault. The poverty problem, same pricks are involved. And, you know, every single problem, you name it, it comes to the same people. And you know, so I became a Marxist. All right, let's do something. Right. So that was that. But the thing I really wanted to talk to you about, one of the problems that they created and which I lived through and experienced, and some of the young men in particular, I'm sure you've dealt with this in your lives, is warrior culture. It's really big, and it's a really seductive way to bring guys in. The other day on Q&A, I was on the Facebook site writing in when the program was on. It was about the culture within the military and stuff like that. And I was writing in there and saying, because they had this Israeli captain on who was just the most offensive individual next to Andrew Bolt that I've ever seen on television. He upset me so much. I was just writing, you know, Israel, what's he saying? You know, this guy is so backwards. He's from a apartheid supporting country. He's, you know, they're a second rate army against a fourth rate enemy. You know, they, and then this other veteran said, oh, because people in the army knew me pretty well. I didn't know who this guy was. He said, oh, yeah, that'd be right, a pogue. And if a pogue is somebody who's not a frontline infantry soldier, even though I was with them all the time, you pogue who's never been in a gunfight, what would you know? You know? And I was just like, it's the warrior culture. It's coming out. This guy is all about I'm Rambo. And it's really important because it was what draws people to war, because you kind of want to be Rambo. You know, you see these movies and you can't turn away like a traffic accident. I'm like that. If you come to my house, all my books are military history, including this one, which I'll be helping Tom launch today. I hope you come along to that on Sunday. But it's, I have this sort of attraction. It's really attractive, this whole military thing. You get like a cool uniform and then I started thinking more and more about our army, the American Marines, the Australian Army. We are, you may as well say the Australian Army is part of the American Army. We really are in many ways, all right? And we go into these countries like Somalia in the early 90s. We've got armored personnel carriers. They've got truck like Yeats with a machine gun on the back that can't really shoot through the armored personnel. We really don't have it that hard. You can go now to Afghanistan. Most likely you'll survive. You could be a cook. You could be a bottle washer or a cook or a PR guy in the back of a truck and hit a roadside bomb and die bravely defending Australian values. But unless you're like this super infantryman, you know, and I'm in combat and then I come home and no one understands me because I'm so fucked up from going in combat and giving my life for you guys and you guys don't even care about me, you know. And I started getting a bit pissed off because we do let ourselves get lured into this. Then we believe it and we believe in the Rambo culture. And then if we end up getting into combat and you survive it, you've got something kind of cool when you get back. You know, Anzac Day is Monday. You'll see it in a big way. I'll get to go there. I can put my medals on. I got 4 medals for turning up. So, like, if you ever played football, if you've ever played football, you've got the best player medal that one guy gets, but then everybody else gets a trophy. right? And I've got that. I've got four of I Was There trophies, right? One of them is for I Was There and I lasted more than 6 years. The other one is I went to Bougainville, which was amazing. I learned to snorkel. The other one was East Timor, which I really enjoyed and got a lot out of. And, it had its times, but I didn't really, I don't really know anybody that had it that hard there. And the other one's the Australian Active Service Medal, which is the one you get for going into a combat zone. But, for most of the time I was in Timor, I knew I was going to be okay. And I think a lot of guys do that. But when you come home, you get to have this whole thing about, he's a veteran. Look, I'm a veteran now, even. And I have a green shirt with a gun on it. As I'm a veteran. And I was thinking maybe I should change my thing from I'm not a veteran against the war, I'm a pogue against the war. You know, or somebody, I was there and I'm against the war or something like it. Or I was at another war and I'm against the war. So this thing gets perpetuated. And then within the veteran culture, we have this whole thing too. Who was the toughest? So really, unless you were landed on Anzac morning and led the bayonet charge against the Turks at the Neck or Lone Pine or whatever, you weren't really there. We have this whole thing in the military, and the system uses this whole warrior thing that you can be cool, you can have all this, and you can be a bit disturbed about it all. As a recruiting thing, people love it. The young guys love it. I think there's a reality to it that's really nasty and really horrible, and the alcoholism and the divorces and all that shit that comes along with it, that is real. But there's a lot of people who kind of like it and want it, and it really is out there. What has this got to do with WikiLeaks? I came here to hear about WikiLeaks. Well, WikiLeaks is interesting because it takes me back to Bradley Manning. Most of you, I hope, know who Bradley Manning is. He's a U.S. private with the end working in intelligence, and he leaked all this stuff. Now he's competent and doing really badly. Not only is Bradley Manning going to be having a horrible time in prison, his guilt, like I felt when I came to Australia after leaving the Marine Corps, is going to just be enormous because his whole life, Australia's becoming this way very, very rapidly, but America was really bad. We grew up in a hugely propagandized society where your country's the best, your flag is the best, you're free, no one else is. You can do whatever you want, no one else can. You have everything, we're the best country in the world, Pledge of Allegiance, all that. You get this total wave of guilt on you about it, and I'm 44 years old now. And it's taken a long time to wash through. I still catch myself when I'm watching the news and they say, the Marines went and killed these guys. I'm like, yeah, fucking Marines. Oh, wait, shit, I don't like that. And there's a part of my brain that's still wired that way. I think it's my football brain because I love, rugby and things too. But it's not all who I am. And I think that whole kind of dual personality thing they bring out. So, they can say, and John talked about it in the film. He was talking about Edward Herman's thing about worthy victims and unworthy victims. And I think that comes into our psyche and it gets played to us a lot. So my whole part of the talk, just to recap, is on how they use that whole warrior culture and this whole manhood thing to lure in particular young men into this club. I think it works a bit different from women, but I can't really speak on that. I have some friends that have talked to me a bit about it as well. And I'm happy to answer those questions or whatever I can on those questions later. So it's just that whole warrior thing. And now we've got Bradley Manning, WikiLeaks, something came and he said, I need to do the right thing. And that kind of came to me as well in my experience. I can't be like my people who were Germans, and because I constantly heard, why didn't anybody say anything? Whoa, when they were carrying their Jewish neighbors away, why didn't they say anything? Why didn't anybody do anything? And now, you know why? Because you become Bradley Manning when you do something. You become Bradley by himself there. And all of us who support him, we are weird. We don't get it. We are crazy people. We are the people that are marginalized. And where do people, they can just look at, oh, that guy, he's a communist, what does he know? He's a this, you know, they're not with it, you know, here, go make money. And, because those are the successful people, are they not? They're the ones that are, Donald Trump, you know, he's a success. You know? It's like Scarface, mutter, I am success. Yeah, it's criminal. We get marginalized, and it pisses me off. And now, of course, within my own veterans culture, they think I'm nuts. You know? So I maybe I should end on a bit of a higher note. I think there's hope. We have the internet, and John's inspired me to go and make some films of my own. So hopefully we'll do that as well and get things out. I mean, I was led that way, and I know of another army officer who's not quite ready to call himself a Marxist yet, but who's interested as well in coming along. Our group is very small. There's about 12 of us that are active and about 30 of us that are sort of out there. That's a platoon strength. The rest of the people think we're nuts, and that my godfather and my kids has been to Afghanistan for quite some time, and he cannot wait to go back again because he just built his new home entertainment system with his tax-free money he made over there. And they love going over there, you know. But he's also disturbed and a veteran now because he got to go to Afghanistan. So we have to be sorry for him as well. Thanks.
Chip. Chip will be here and be answering questions and participating in the discussion later on as well. But our second speaker is Josh Lees, who is Josh has been an anti-war activist for a decade, and he's been a member of Socialist Alternative Sydney branch for the past 6 years. He's currently active in the Refugee Action Collective, and he's also part of Students Against Racism at Macquarie University. So please welcome Josh.
Okay, well, obviously the war on terror has been, you know, waging now around the world for almost a decade now. You know, it's a war which has been a so-called war, which has been a very useful catch-all justification for the US empire and its allies to run riot around the world, to rampage wherever they want in the world, and, of course, to wage a similar war against our civil liberties, against our rights at home. It's a war which has given us, you know, countless deaths, millions of people killed in Iraq, Afghanistan, and around the world, thousands more, tens of thousands, really, tortured in secret prisons, in the prisons we know about, Guantanamo Bay, Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and plenty of other places, including in the United States, people like Bradley Manning now. And I think we can say that the war on terror was based on two big lies, which I think now have been pretty thoroughly discredited amongst, you know, all around the world, amongst the mass of the population. The two big lies I'm going to talk about, the first, of course, was that, you know, Islamic terrorism was this preeminent threat to our way of life. It was something kind of inexplicable. These Muslims just hated us. We didn't know why. It was because we were so free or something. You know, they just hated the idea that we were free, so they had to blow us up. All this kind of crap. That's the first big lie. And the second big lie, I think, which actually was more pervasive, actually, was that Western intervention could be a civilizing force in the world, that the West, Western imperialism, could bring democracy, could liberate women, and so on. And as I said, I think these two kind of big lies of the war on terror have been utterly discredited now, but I'm going to go through a bit about the history of that war and exactly, you know, what we know now. Obviously, the current situation is that we still have an occupation in Iraq. You know, they're trying to tell us that war's over, but actually there's still tens of thousands of US troops occupying Iraq, defending their kind of puppet government, which, you know, hasn't gone so well for the US because that government is also heavily influenced by Iran. That's a whole other story. But also the US, you know, troops are based in these mega bases, permanent military bases, which they, don't plan on removing anytime soon. Just recently, actually, we've seen mass protests against the occupation again in Iraq. It's inspired by the revolutions that have broken out in Tunisia and Egypt. I might come back to that a bit more. In Afghanistan, of course, the other key country at the moment in the imperialist adventures in the Middle East, it's a bit of a disaster for the US at the moment. All of the troops, which have been taken out of Iraq have by and large not come home. They've been sent, to Afghanistan as part of Obama's, troop surge, in a war which he always argued, was the good war as opposed to the bad war, in Iraq. There those troops, remain, as I said, utterly bogged down. They're defending, the most corrupt, anti-woman regime in the entire world. At the moment, it's a regime made up of drug dealers, and warlords, people like, the president's brother. In fact, Hamid Karzai's brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, who is, renowned for being one of the richest people in Afghanistan based on his control of the opium trade. And he's also been on the CIA payroll, since 2001. It's the same kinds of people, now being backed by the occupying forces, in some cases, the exact same individuals, in fact, who they used to back. An arm, of course, against the Soviets in the 1980s. The people they then called freedom fighters and later called Islamic terrorists and now called freedom fighters again, including people, of course, like Osama bin Laden himself and so on. Before switching sides to support the Taliban and now switching back again when the Taliban failed to sufficiently uphold U.S. interests. Obama, of course, the great anti-war hope for us all. Like Kevin Rudd and Gillard here in Australia, have not been any alternative, have not given us any difference, have not given us any opposition to the same strategy of war and carnage around the world. Instead, it's been more of the same. In Afghanistan, as I said, Obama's launched a troop surge. He has particular way you can see the US is ever going to win that war. But the troop surge has seen a huge rise in civilian casualties. It's seen a huge expansion in nighttime raids where routinely soldiers, I'll talk more about this, where routinely soldiers burst into the wrong house, kill everyone, women, children, everything else. It's been a huge increase in airstrikes, again, resulting in enormous amounts of civilian casualties. And there's been a huge increase in the great other strategy of the US, which is to try and buy off more of the warlords in the hope of finding some exit strategy in the foreseeable future. People might have seen part of this whole Obama strategy particularly towards the end of last year. They started talking about the great successes they were having in negotiating with the so-called moderate Taliban in order to win them away so that they could go after the really bad Taliban and the US would be able to get out. I'll just read a little report about that, which kind of tells you how well the US is going in Afghanistan. This is a report from the New York Times, broke this story in November the 22nd last year. For months, the secret talks unfolding between Taliban and Afghan leaders to end the war appeared to be showing promise, if only because of the appearance of a certain insurgent leader at one end of the table, Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour, one of the most senior commanders of the Taliban movement. NATO and Afghan officials said they held three meetings with the man. He traveled in from Pakistan, where Taliban leaders have taken refuge. He was flying around on NATO helicopters. He, in fact, met with the president, Hamid Karzai, he was ushered into the presidential palace and so on. There's only one problem with this, as the New York Times reports. As it turns out, Mr. Mansour was apparently not Mr. Mansour at all. In fact, it turned out to be a shopkeeper from Quetta, who had walked in claiming to be a Taliban leader. And this is, again, how the New York Times reports it. It's not him, said a Western diplomat in Kabul, immediately involved in the discussions. And we gave him a lot of money. In fact, they heaped millions and millions of dollars onto this guy, again, as part of their strategy of trying to buy off friendly warlords. Turns out, wrong guy.
Much bigger shop.
Yeah, you can see why the US is worried about the certain prestige problem they face if they're seen to be defeated in Afghanistan. A problem which they're facing already, suggested by that story. WikiLeaks, of course, has helped us to document the whole litany of war crimes and atrocities carried out in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the rest of the world. In Iraq, of course, one of the most famous leaks was that one called Collateral Murder, which is anyone can watch on WikiLeaks, on YouTube, sorry, if they haven't already. It's the horrific video of the US gunship gunning down those civilians in Iraq. And then when other people turn up to help them, they get gunned down as well. The soldiers are kind of laughing about it, you know, wanting to shoot more, and all the rest of it. Absolutely horrific video, and just one of the many, many atrocities that we've seen, over the last 9.5 years. Incidentally, one of the US troops who was on the ground, in Baghdad at the time, subsequently, he wasn't in the helicopter, he was on the ground, and he turned up to the scene afterwards, and he described this whole scene as well. He said, this is Army Specialist Ethan McCord. He said he approached the van and found a girl inside, about 3 or 4, with a stomach wound and glass in her eye. Her brother, 7, was lying half on the floor next to her, and her father was slumped over the wheel dead. And this was, you know, amongst dozens of people who were killed. After the whole WikiLeaks story broke, this soldier, Ethan McCord, together with another soldier, Josh Stiber, actually wrote an open letter of apology to the Iraqi people. In this letter, they wrote that McCord wrote, "I pulled your daughter and son from the van, and when doing so, saw the faces of my own children back home. The people of the United States need to realize what we have done and are doing to you and the people of your country." And he said, he asked what we can do to repair the damage we've caused. He said, "I went to Iraq because I thought I was going to help people." And then he says, "I was living in a fairy tale. Obviously, our job was not to protect the Iraqi people. It was more along the lines to out-terrorize the terrorists." And I think that kind of sums up as well the whole effect of the US invasions and everything like that. And in fact, following the WikiLeaks cables and everything which came out, one of the Berlin newspaper, the Tagesschau, that's probably a terrible pronunciation, but this is what the Berlin newspaper said, which kind of gives you an idea of the scale of what's happened in Iraq. They say that the WikiLeaks documents provide evidence of numerous war crimes and other severe US breaches of the Geneva Convention ratified by Washington. The US justice system has only opened investigations in fewer than 5% of all of these cases. Only a handful of lower-ranking people were convicted, and in most cases they've received short prison sentences. The military commanders and the people politically responsible for the crimes, right up to President Bush and his vice president, Dick Cheney, were not called to task. And again, that is the story of the war on terror. Countless atrocities, well documented now, thanks to WikiLeaks, and you know, nothing happened about pretty much any of them. Of course, the same story in Afghanistan, where again, there's been 200,000 pages of war logs from the invasion and occupation leaked by WikiLeaks. And again, they document a huge increase in drone attacks and airstrikes under Obama, the widespread existence of US death squads. Again, effectively those nighttime raids where, you know, they just get any old tip-off from some warlord they're backing in the region, as Anand Gopal was talking about before, if anyone heard him speak, you know, storm in, kill anyone they like, and walk away from it. So widespread use of death squads currently going on, and cover-ups again. And if people have seen recently, there's been a bit of attention focused in Australia, because two Australian soldiers are now facing a court-martial in July for a particular episode in Afghanistan. And these are, in fact, the first US soldiers in, well, decades and decades and decades, at least, that I know of. Not a single Australian soldier was ever prosecuted during the entire Vietnam War for any of the crimes carried out then. These are the first soldiers to ever be prosecuted in the last 9.5 years. And if people know the story, this is when the Australian death squad, effectively, again, received one of these tip-offs that there's a, you know, Taliban militants in this house. This is on the early morning of February the 12th, 2009. They were seeking to kill or capture this alleged Taliban leader called Mullah Nurullah. Instead, they smashed their way into a compound housing the families of two other brothers, Zahir and Amrullah Khan. And the Australian troops basically stormed in there. They alleged that someone shot back at them. Perhaps they did, perhaps they didn't. If I was in Afghanistan, I had a gun and people stormed into my door at 2 a.m, I'd start shooting as well. But anyway, they threw some grenades in and they killed 6 people, including 5 children. Boys aged 10 and 11, another 2-year-old girl, a 1-year-old boy were killed. 4 other people were wounded, another 2 of them children. And one of the brothers, Amrullah Khan, himself was killed. Again, a horrific war crime carried out, as so many others are, in Afghanistan. And again, I said 2 of these soldiers are now being prosecuted, but actually they're only being prosecuted not because of anything the Australian military did to investigate this crime, but entirely because of the work of the surviving brother, Zahir Khan, who got in touch with the SBS in Australia and some other people, Farid Popal, particular guy, and they actually went out to Afghanistan to investigate this war crime. They reported on it. They gave all the information. Dateline did a whole report on it, if people remember seeing it. And it was only after that, really, that this prosecution came into existence. If not, it would have been covered up like the thousands of other, countless other, who knows, crimes and everything going on every day in these countries. So, I think the overall point, hopefully people can see, is that, Australia, like America and everyone else, we are not a civilizing force anywhere in the world. And this is, as I said, thanks in no small part to WikiLeaks, which has been important in at least documenting these things, which we perhaps knew were going on anyway, but they've actually helped to document them in a way which can no longer, hopefully can no longer be ignored as much. Now, WikiLeaks has also helped to expose the kind of imperialist machinations that go on, that really motivate and lie behind all these kinds of wars and everything. Because it hasn't just been, obviously, what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. The war on terror has encompassed a whole number of crimes around the world. We've seen leaks about, the British backing death squads in Bangladesh, about Australia's backing for the Indonesian, brutal secret military police and everything, the Capacitas forces, which brutalised the people of Aceh, previously East Timor, West Papua, and so on. So again, I think this first, as I said, the first big lie of the war on terror, that this is about fighting terrorists and all that kind of stuff, I think has been utterly destroyed, and even more so now with the release of WikiLeaks. Instead, we can see actually the real terrorists in the world, of course, are our governments, are our militaries who rampage around the world. And to the extent there are any, Islamic terrorists, they're entirely a response to the foreign policies of countries like Australia and the United States. And in many cases, actually, they were previously backed and funded by the very same governments and everything like that. Now, the other big lie, as I said, is the idea that the US and its allies can bring democracy or civilization or anything like to anyone. And I think, again, as I said, most people around the world actually never bought these lies. That's why millions of people marched against the war in Iraq and everything like that. But now, with the release of WikiLeaks, it's kind of really like the US empire has been really kind of trying to rub our noses in their own hypocrisy. People might have seen that on the very same day, actually, that Julian Assange was arrested and he was denied bail in London. At the same time that the US administration was doing all it could to shut down WikiLeaks, everything like that, this is on exactly the same day the US State Department actually issued a press release titled US to Host World Press Freedom Day in 2011. And it goes on. It's just mind-boggling. They said, new media has empowered citizens around the world to report on their circumstances, express opinions on world events, and exchange information in environments sometimes hostile to such exercises of individuals' right to freedom of expression. They said at the same time, we are concerned about the determination of some governments to censor and silence individuals and to restrict the free flow of information. We mark events such as World Press Freedom Day in the context of our enduring commitment to support and expand press freedom and free flow of information in the digital age. Hands on your hearts, everybody. It really was now. With this release of WikiLeaks, the attacks on Assange and everything like that, it's like the emperor had lost all his clothes long ago. Now he was kind of dancing around on stage like a kind of drunken Boris Yeltsin or something performance, everything like that. Absolutely rubbing our faces in their hypocrisy. Of course, we saw all the big businesses, Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, all the rest of it, abandon WikiLeaks, heavy by the US government. Of course, they were still funding, happy to take transactions to fund the KKK in America and other wonderful organizations like that, but you could no longer try to support WikiLeaks via them.
Christian.
Now, of course, the situation of Bradley Manning, Chip's already talked about, absolutely dire. He's been held in solitary confinement for, must be about 10 months now, 23 hours a day, kept in his tiny cell, stripped naked every night, and brutalized in a whole series of ways in order to, try to break him and to try to send a message to everyone else. Don't you dare do what this, brave hero, I think, has done and release the truth about the empire. Now, we have seen recently that he's actually been moved to another prison, which seems like a small victory, and a victory won by the tireless campaigning of his, you know, lawyers and family and supporters around the world, and everything like that. So, you know, we welcome that. But still, you know, this is an outrage. It's an absolute outrage, an indictment of the world we live in, that someone like Bradley Manning can be rotting in prison, you know, a man who has not done anything to ever hurt a fly, and yet the actual war criminals who he exposed through his leaks and everything remain free. They remain the presidents of the United States. They remain the prime ministers in Australia, all the generals and all the officers and everything who have carried out these war crimes, which he helped to expose. They remain free, and the man who's in prison is the one who dared to tell the truth. This is an outrage. And of course, it's not just Manning, it's not just Assange, it's the thousands of others I talked about who have been victimized in this way, by the war on terror, by the crackdowns on our civil liberties, by the, you know, kind of witch hunts which have gripped the whole world, as the, you know, the US and in Australia here as well, as they look for terrorists wherever they can find them or manufacture them to justify the ongoing war. So, of course, the whole history of Guantanamo Bay, of Mamda Habib, of David Hicks, of Mohammed Hanif in Australia, and the thousands of others all around the world. And I think, you know, even more fundamentally, WikiLeaks has helped to expose the entire farce that is the nature of capitalist democracy. You know, what a total farce of a democracy we live in, where this is the state of affairs. You know, Marxists have always said that we don't, you know, that really we live in a dictatorship of capital, and that, you know, we can never have a decent world until we overthrow that. And one of the things which, following the Russian Revolution, actually, in 1917, one of the first acts of the new Soviet government was to do something very simple, which nevertheless sent total shockwaves all around the world, and that was that they published the secret treaties of the Tsarist government and the pro-capitalist government, the provisional government, which followed. You know, this is a very simple act, but it exposed, in one fell swoop, all the lies surrounding the First World War. It exposed the fact that all these powers were fighting a war of conquest, not of defense or anything as they tried to claim and everything like that. And Trotsky wrote at the time, I think he really summed it up, that secret diplomacy, the kind of which they're so desperate to hang on to through all their attacks on WikiLeaks and everything, Trotsky wrote that secret diplomacy is a necessary tool for a propertied minority which is compelled to deceive the majority in order to subject it to its interests. I think that really sums up the whole role of, you know, the secrecy which they're so determined to cling on to, and exposes the fact we don't live in anything you could call a true democracy, where the governments, you know, actually are trying to hide what they're really doing from us. And as I said, you know, they released all of these secret treaties of the Russian imperialism, as Trotsky said, because the abolition of secret diplomacy is the primary condition for an honest, popular, truly democratic foreign policy. An honest, popular, and truly democratic foreign policy is clearly not on the minds of Obama, Gillard, and co. Around the world. Now, obviously, the war on terror, I think it's no surprise to anyone, is really about imperialism. It's about the interests of the United States as the world's biggest superpower and its allies around the world trying to expand and secure their position as the number one imperialist power in the world. You know, this is a project launched, of course, you know, in 2001 they invaded Afghanistan as a stepping stone, really, to be able to invade Iraq. You know, and these two countries are at the center of some of the most resource-rich regions in the entire world. Iraq, in particular, of course, at the center of what, you know, the neocons and the Bush administration hoped would be a reshaping of the entire Middle East in a way which would, you know, massively benefit U.S. influence in the region, where they could just set up military bases wherever they wanted, where they could have even, you know, even more kind of friendly dictators in the region, where they wouldn't be able to, you know, they wouldn't have to stop at Afghanistan and Iraq. Perhaps they could roll on to Syria, Iran, you know, the rest of the famed Axis of Evil, remember, and all the rest of it. That was their entire goal, entirely motivated by the wishes of the U.S. empire to maintain its position as the number one, leader of the pack, so to speak. Now, clearly, that entire imperialist project, the U.S. has not had it all its own way. That the war in Iraq is widely perceived as a total disaster by the U.S. ruling class. That's why they were so happy to dump Bush at the end of his reign and try to bring in Obama to, be the new face of imperialism to try and restabilize their empire around the world. Afghanistan, as I said, is increasingly a quagmire with no end in sight, no victory in sight, certainly, for the United States. But I think this is no reason either for us to be complacent. You know, the U.S. at the same time has not been, roundly defeated in either of these countries either, and they still retain clearly the ability to launch further wars, invasions, and bombing campaigns around the world, as we've seen now in Libya. which I think really is an attempt by the US to try and reclaim the momentum of their empire in the Middle East and everything like that. I think the other thing WikiLeaks has shown us, kind of in the negative actually, is that exposing the truth about the world won't change it by itself. You know, merely exposing the truth, merely having, you know, all of these war crimes documented on the internet, merely us seeing even the very words of the kind of functionaries of imperialism, of the diplomats and the spies and everything like that, telling us exactly how the world works for the first time, kind of honestly, because they were talking to each other, they weren't talking to us, knowing all of that by itself will not change the world. You know, empire clearly is not just collapsing now simply because all of their lies and their crimes have been exposed. And I think that's an important lesson, because at the time of the WikiLeaks cables, a lot of people were talking about, you know, a cyber revolution. This is going to change everything. Well, actually, you know, not that the WikiLeaks things aren't helpful, not that we didn't learn a lot from them, but actually by themselves, they won't actually challenge the empire. And I think, you know, thankfully what we're seeing now throughout the Middle East is, you know, what can challenge empire, what can challenge the United States and Australia's interest and everything like that. Because now I think we really are seeing the most serious challenge to US imperialism for decades and decades in the revolutions which have swept Tunisia, Egypt, and are starting to challenge, you know, some of the US's, you know, most friendly dictators in the Middle East, in you know, in Bahrain, in Yemen, and so on and so forth. And I think these are the most serious challenges to imperialism, to the whole war on terror and everything like that, precisely because these movements involve the mass of the population. They involve the mass of people in a struggle to actually put their own agency and their own wishes for the future, you know, at the center stage and everything like that. That they challenge, you know, not just a dictatorship or whatever, but actually they challenge the entire inequality of power and wealth, which is at the heart of imperialism. Because we need to remember that as long as we have capitalism, as long as we have a world where profits and the competition between big businesses, the competition between nation states which flows from that, as long as we live in that kind of world, actually we're always going to live in a world of war, of empire, and all of the, you know, racism and all of the rest of it which goes along with that. And that's what those movements now in the Middle East have the potential to challenge, in a way in which, you know, the Taliban or any of these other kinds of, you know, the leader, you know, Iran or Syria or any of these people who might have posed as being anti-imperialist, the current mass movements have a way of sweeping aside the US empire in a way in which none of these ever have before. So I think our task here in Australia, just to wrap up, is to be the most intransigent opponents of imperialism. We have to learn the lessons of the last 9.5 years of the war on terror, and there's been so many, you know, that we should absolutely oppose all of the racist ideology which underlies the war on terror, all of the attacks on Muslims around the world, all of the attacks on our civil liberties which are justified by the war on terror. Every single intervention of our government or of the US government anywhere in the world needs to be opposed before it even happens, you know, wherever it is. And we should never again, ever believe the lies of the imperialists when they try and say, we're going to help people, we're going to overthrow a dictator, you know, we're going to liberate women, any of that crap, we should never again, you know, believe if we ever did in the first place. I think secondly, we need to draw inspiration from those movements now sweeping through the Middle East. You know, I haven't had much time to talk about them. There's been plenty of other sessions where they have been spoken about, but I think we can draw inspiration from those movements. We can learn the lessons from them. And we need to build that kind of alternative, here in Australia, one which puts, you know, the idea that we need to sweep aside capitalism actually at its very heart. Because as I said, you know, as long as we have a system based on profit and competition, we're always going to have, you know, a version of the war on terror. You know, of course, the war on terror is just the latest in a long line of kind of catch-all justifications for imperialism, whether it was, you know, the Cold War, the war on communism, the war on drugs, and whatever. Now we have the war on terror, which needs to be opposed as well. And I'll just leave us, I think, with one of probably my favorite quotes, favorite slogans from those massive anti-war marches around the world, millions of people who marched against the Iraq War in 2003. I think my favorite slogan of all of those many which were on display was that regime change begins at home. I think that's what we need to take to heart here in Australia.